3CR's Turn 40, and from Monday 10th of October right through to Saturday 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.
Hello, I'm Sarah Lestrange. On today's program, Affirmative Politics, I look at women's representation in the Australian Parliament. I explore the Affirmative Action Party quota debate and look at the cultural barriers to women's involvement in politics in Australia. So now, let's journey into the not-so-distant past, rummage through the hundreds of cassettes we have in the Women on the Line archives, and bring you a pivotal part of women's contribution to Australian politics in the 1980s. While in opposition in 1981, Senator Susan Ryan of the Australian Labor Party introduced a private members' bill. And then, when the ALP came into power, this private members' bill became the Sex Discrimination Act of 1984 and the Affirmative Action Act of 1986. These acts made it illegal to discriminate on the grounds of sex, marital status, or pregnancy. The bill also outlawed sexual harassment in the workplace, and this was the first time in Australia such protection had been legislated. These bills, however, were not passed without a fight. Susan Ryan was vilified by the right, which rallied to stop the Ryan juggernaut.
The bill constitutes an attack upon our traditional values, and the importance of the family as the fundamental unit of society and our traditional way of life. Indeed, the architects of the legislation, including the now notorious Ryan Ronalds team, were accused of tainting the legislation as a whole with the pseudo-intellectualism of selfish and unrepresentative feminism and doctrine Marxist socialist precepts of contrived equality, defying even the laws of nature.
They might have been laughing in the audience in 1987 when Susan Ryan gave this speech, and today we might still laugh at the paranoia of some who saw women being protected from sexual harassment as a threat to the family. Now, 20 years on, this legislation has shaped the lives not only of women but the whole nation, so that the catch cry of women in politics, that women's issues are everyone's issues, rings true. And the question needs to be asked: without women on the ground at Parliament House, would such bills have been put forward? I think it's unlikely. Even though women in Australia have had the vote since 1902, it's largely been recognised that we've been slow in the march for equal parliamentary representation. At the same time Ryan made her speech, there were 6% of women in the lower house of federal parliament. At this time, there was no affirmative action quotas for pre-selection on either side of politics. Now, 20 years on, there are 23% of women in the lower house. This is higher than the world average of 16%, but lower than countries like Afghanistan. In fact, Rwanda has the highest representation of women in politics in the world, at 48%, leading even the Nordic countries. So how has affirmative action shaped Australian politics? We'll hear from the movers and shakers in this debate who spoke to women on the line over the years. Australia does not have a constitutional quota, nor election law for equal representation in national parliament. In 1994, an affirmative action quota system was introduced into the fabric of the ALP for the pre-selection of candidates for winnable seats. It aimed for a 35% quota of women candidates. This opened a wave of debate around whether it would work and whether it derailed the idea of pre-selection based on merit. Joan Kerner, the former Victorian Premier, tabled her affirmative action plan at the National ALP Conference. She's speaking here to Rachel Petrow.
Well, the debate is centred on whether we should have a rule change to reflect the target, which is to have half the Labor Party representation being women by the year 2000 or the election closest to it.
Is this the first time that the issue's been on the ALP's national conference agenda?
It's the first time that the issue of pre-selection, affirmative action for pre-selection, has been on the ALP conference agenda. Prior to that, and in our rules, we've got affirmative action for office holders in the party. But the pre-selection process is specifically excluded from affirmative action. So at the very least, we have to get that prevention removed.
But would it have an impact?
Well, I don't want to sound mean-spirited, and I think the women within the ALP who worked for it are entitled to feel really glad and pleased with what they've done. But I think I've got two responses, and one is it really indicates how far behind the ideal of an accurate reflection of the community it is for a political party. We should be saying 50% now because that's what the community is. But instead, the ALP is struggling to get 35% by the turn of the century. And the Liberal Party is even further behind by saying, well, obviously women don't deserve to be there yet.
Christine Milne from the Greens talking in 1994 about the ALP's policy of affirmative action for pre-selection. However, this change was needed because before affirmative action, the number of women in Parliament was increasing at a snail's pace. Janet Powell, then the leader of the Democrats.
The last federal election saw parliamentary representation for women in this country increase by only one. In raw figures, 28 out of 224, 12.5%. At this rate, one per election, using the average 30-month post-war average period between elections and assuming no increase in the numbers in Parliament, we need 84 additional new members to achieve parity, and this will occur in the year 2300. I could soften the blow with another figure using the increase of six per year. That's the national average, including state results, which of course we should do tonight with two state premiers. It looks as though it will only take about 54 years for women to achieve parity across Australia. So obviously, things have to change.
It seems the policy did have an impact. The rate in 1993 was 10%, and by 1998, it had more than doubled. But what about the idea of merit? The notion of affirmative action suggested women would be put forward above stronger male candidates. Mary Owen from WELL, the women's electoral lobby that was formed in 1972 and lobbies to make women's right more visible in Parliament, had strong views on this topic.
Tell me, when were men selected on their ability? Men are selected because they're put forth by a particular faction, or because they live in a particular state, or because somebody owes them something, or because they're a good numbers cruncher.
Given this bias, was there a need for a women's party? Deb Nicholson, Victorian Senate candidate for the Australian Women's Party in 1998.
I think it would be fair to say that the Australian Women's Party considers that all issues are women's issues, like tax, for example, and not just issues that a lot of people traditionally think only concern women, such as childcare or education or health. That the Australian Women's Party has got a range of policies on issues such as gun control, violence in the community, not just violence against women, education, defence, tax. You know, and I guess that our, you know, the main thing that we're trying to do is to say that women have to be involved in all aspects of decision making at a political level, you know, at all levels of government, and they're not.
Since affirmative action, there have been more women in the ALP than the Conservatives, but having quotas or a women's party is not the only way to get women into politics. Think of the legacy of the Australian Democrats. They had the first female federal leader of a political party in Australia's history, the late Janine Haines. And the majority of its leaders since Janine Haines have also been women. There was Janet Powell, Cheryl Curnow, Natasha Stott-Despoja, Meg Lees, and now Lynn Allison. But the Democrats don't have an affirmative action policy. Powell spells out how they've managed to get the representation so fair without this policy.
I think, as a woman who leads a political party whose extraordinary record of female representation is a bright spot on the Australian scene, I think an explanation of why women are so well represented in the Australian Democrats will probably assist us in our thinking about how we might achieve the genuine equality of opportunity. At present, as you know, of our eight senators, four are women. We've got the 50%. Marion Sawyer has observed that the Democrats are, and I quote, seen as an avenue for women frustrated with the traditional parties. Its willingness to take women seriously and its attraction for many women have resulted in a relatively large number of women parliamentary candidates. Even where direct action is taken to ensure inclusion of women by affirmative action, quotas or whatever, old habits do die hard. Old boys' networks built up over generations can really be almost unassailable. Simply because the Democrats didn't start until 1977, we therefore carry none of that baggage. I think the basic philosophical approach, the world view, resulting in what I'd call progressive reformist policies, others wouldn't be so charitable, is also a factor. And I think that attracts a generally socially enlightened membership, both male and female. And I can tell you, that's the kind of male that it's best to work with. Perhaps the key feature of the Australian Democrats, though, that I want to point to, which underpins that genuine equality of opportunity, is the decision-making process, participatory democracy. This is the way that all major decisions in our party are made. Our policies are made by the vote of members, our executive positions and other positions and other major decisions, and of course, uniquely, our parliamentary leadership is also a matter for all members. And I believe that that structural difference is a major factor in the advancement of women in the Democrats. I think we've developed a breeding ground, if you like, in which capable women have been nurtured, not artificially, but organically, so to speak.
But it has to be said that the real politic, at times, has shaped the Democrats just as much as other parties. And Christine Milne from the Greens criticised their preferencing in the 1995 federal elections.
In terms of the Democrats, it was just tragic here when they directed their preferences to Fred Niles' call to Australia before the Greens and put the Women's Party last, not only here in Tasmania but in New South Wales, where they put the Women's Party after the shooters. Now, there is no justification whatsoever for the Democrats doing that other than pure trading for votes, and when it gets to that level, then there is no principle involved in it, and I think the Democrats have really hurt themselves by doing that.
You're listening to Women on the Line. I'm Sarah Lestrange. This is a special series called On the Record, 20 Years of Women's Radio, a chronicle of key feminist issues covered on the program since 1986. Today's program, Affirmative Politics, looks at women's representation in the Australian Parliament. The voices you hear are from our archives. Let's turn now to the 1998 federal election. This is when Charmaine Clark from the Greens was hoping to become the first Aboriginal woman elected into Parliament. The Howard government had been in power for 2 years. Election issues at the time centred around WIC and the Jabiluka uranium mine. Clark is talking here to Fiona Sewell.
It's going to be a very interesting race because I think people don't realise that it is also a message about what we as Australians are. Where this is our opportunity to say where we want to go. You know, you've got such a myriad of choices. Australians need to start considering, well, what does it mean to be an Australian? I think it's going to be quite an interesting outlook. But I think my chances are fairly good.
Well, if you did get up, you'd be the very first Indigenous woman in an Australian Parliament.
Yeah, it's a bit of a daunting... Yeah, I would be the first, but definitely not the last.
Unfortunately, Clark wasn't the first. This was an election dominated by another woman, Pauline Hanson, who entered the lower house in 1996 and caused an absolute storm, with the strength of her support reaching 20% in some areas from voters. This would have been a tough battle for Charmaine Clark, but she was correct in saying she wouldn't be the last Aboriginal woman to stand. And in 2001, Carol Martin was elected in Western Australia as the first Aboriginal woman to hold a parliamentary seat. Since then, numbers have grown, and Claire Martin's Northern Territory government has a record number of 3 female Aboriginal members.
You're listening to 3CR's 40 Days of Radical Radio special, celebrating 3CR's 40 fabulous years of community radio.
But what can be done to make politics more accessible for women of all backgrounds? It's important to remember that there were no women involved in the formation of the Australian Constitution in the 1890s. Some women say that this had a dramatic impact on the culture of Australian politics since. So, when the Republic debate came to the fore in the 1990s, 100 years later, women saw a real possibility for change. While there was Howard's People's Convention in 1997, there was a separate Women's Constitutional Convention held in 1998, where prominent women and community groups talked about what changes they'd make to the Australian system as a republic. They asked, could the Commonwealth Electoral Act be revised to guarantee 50% representation of women in Australia? Would there be a Bill of Rights? How would Aboriginal land rights be acknowledged in the new constitution? But were women consulted enough in mainstream politics about what they wanted? Cheryl Curnow.
Not at all. I think it's very true that the so-called minimalist position is such a narrow, non-inclusive position, which is being espoused by people like Paul Keating and Malcolm Turnbull, and I just don't think that appeals to women. Women are much more concerned and understand the complexities, the interrelationships and the longer term consequences, and trying to confine something to, well, here's the ready-made solution, it's a minimalist one, I think makes the majority of women turn right off.
We can always dream, and after the republic model Howard put forward was rejected in the 1999 referendum, Women on the Line producer Kath Kearney took to the streets to ask women what they thought would have to happen for an Australian woman to be head of state.
The referendum has been and gone, the dust has settled. I took to the streets to ask women what they thought would need to happen for an Australian woman to be head of state.
I think we need to break the glass ceiling for a start, so that women are earning equal pay. Basically, I think women need to be treated equally, which I don't believe we are.
A miracle.
My niece to grow up.
What do you think needs to happen for an Australian woman to be head of state?
The whole fabric of society has to change, and men and women have to see each other as equal.
So, if it's all dreaming, what are the barriers to women getting involved in politics? Julia Baird is a social commentator, and in 2004, she published a book called Media Tarts, How the Australian Press Frames Female Politicians.
We're not used to seeing women exercising power or having authority. So you can see there's a pattern of reportage. If we go back to the way that women are presented in the press right from the 1960s and 70s through to the current day, when they first became ministers, it was all this, iron hand in the velvet glove, and when people made decisions, it was like, woo, she's one tough lady, whether they were cutting their budget or adding to their budget, or, you know, particularly if they were retrenching staff or doing that kind of thing, there were all these Iron Maiden headlines. So it's fairly standard political fare to have to make decisions when you're a minister. But it's seen as an almost ruthless streak in women. I think that there's an underlying cultural belief that we don't think that kind of thing comes naturally to them.
Then, of course, there's the issue of children and families. Julia Gillard attracted attention recently for saying that it would be very difficult to be a political leader with young children. She won't have them. And studies across Western democracies show that female politicians tend to be either divorced or single, and also tend to be childless or have teenagers. Male politicians, on the other hand, tend to be married with children. Natasha Stott-Despoja, who has a young family, is leaving politics because of the strain of balancing the two demands of politics and family. Even when women do manage the balance between a personal and private life, they can be criticised. Think about when Janine Haines was leader of the Democrats. Her partner was described as the first house husband. Here's Julia Baird again.
People marvelled over him, and they would describe in great detail what he did. So Ian Haines will do the washing and drive his children to school and cook them soup for dinner. And how do you do it all, Ian? And he's like, well, it's not that hard to do the washing, actually, and a lot of women managed to cope to do it. But it was seen as this kind of incredibly peculiar and slightly emasculating thing, and I think that's been really a really irritating thing for men who are spouses of female politicians, to get this whole Maggie Thatcher tag, as though it's embarrassing to have a woman who's in an influential position as your wife, which is bizarre, because a lot of them, especially a lot of those earlier house husbands, were asked perennially if they minded. Now, can you imagine the wives of, you know, Jeanette Howard? Do you mind that your husband is the Prime Minister? Is that awful and embarrassing for you? You know, I don't think it is.
To me, one of the key things to getting women into politics is money. A lot of women can't afford to stand. They simply don't have the same financial base. And unfortunately, it's not going to change with the Conservatives.
That's Christine Milne. This is why Emily's List was formed in 1996. It aimed to get more progressive Labour women elected to Parliament by providing financial support and guidance. It says it's helped over 100 ALP women get into Parliament. The founder of Emily's List was Joan Kerner, who became Labour leader in 1990 and Victoria's first female premier. She knew all about the barriers to women in politics.
When I arrived in Cabinet, fortunately for me, with Caroline Hogg, so we weren't like Susan Ryan was in the Federal Cabinet alone, the decisions in Cabinet that were good decisions were often described by my confreres as decisions that had balls. I didn't like that much. I didn't think it was a very accurate description. So I said one day when I'd had enough of it, I said, look, that was a great decision. It really has breasts. And I haven't heard the expression about balls since.
And you see, they've got to get at you all the time, as Chris Publick did to Margaret Reynolds. I mean, in 1989, that man, Liberal Senator from New South Wales, felt quite able to stand up in the Australian Senate and put on the record a comment about Margaret Reynolds, then Minister for Local Government and the Arts and so on, in her absence, a statement that said, Senator Reynolds should never forget that she's on the front bench only because of the number of chromosomes she's got and not the number of neurons she's got. And not one of her colleagues leapt in and defended her. It was quite the most extraordinary thing. I was temporarily bereft of words for once in my life. It was just the most astonishing comment to make in the late 1980s.
Janine Haynes. She sadly died in 2004, but she had a lasting impact on politics and she fought to raise the profile of women's issues in Parliament.
I had the chance to initiate a number of debates in the Senate chamber on things like violence against women, and we had real difficulty filling up the allocated time with speakers. They just simply were not interested. Whereas, you know, if some bloke moved to have a debate on a 2% sales tax on wine, the list of people who wanted to speak was almost endless. I mean, they ran out of time before they ran out of speakers. What is important to men gets a lot of attention. What is important to women and their children, and that means well over half the population, gets what's left over.
With all of these barriers, why do women do it? Democrat Senator Natasha Stott-Despoja, speaking in 1996.
Well, I got involved in politics. Well, I have been involved on and off for a decade now, and it was that genuine sense of being fairly outspoken to begin with, but wanting to make a difference. I didn't necessarily think that the political channel I would choose would be the Parliament, but the reason I've got involved in the Parliament now is because I think it is time for a young woman to get in there, and young women, more young people generally. And I think I've already had some kind of demonstrable impact, if only a symbolic one perhaps, to show people in the community that it can be done, that it is worth doing. But you never know. I mean, after my term, which will end in 2002, obviously I want to review whether or not I have had a realistic and meaningful impact on social and economic policy in this country. And I intend to, but there are quite a few challenges out there when you're facing a lot of old stereotypes and an old party system that tends to vote together more often than comes up with creative and new ideas.
By 2008, Natasha Stott-Despoja will be the longest-serving senator in her party. But she has announced she'll be leaving politics then. This could well mark the end of the Democrats as a force in Australia. But the legacy on Australian politics of women's strong presence in that party will hopefully be maintained. Now, from the longest-serving Democrat senator to the longest-serving female cabinet minister in Australia's history, and she's not from the left or centre of politics, but from the Conservatives. It's none other than Amanda Vanstone. Recently deposed of her role in the Cabinet as Minister for Immigration, she's going to be shipped off to Italy as Australia's ambassador. Julia Baird has a certain fondness for Amanda Vanstone.
I don't see her as particularly hard, agree or not with what she does. She's actually one of the more accessible human people in politics today, I think. If you've ever heard her speak, she's pretty funny. She can be self-deprecating. She doesn't put up with any nonsense. But I think just because she fights back. It wouldn't strike me as hard. I think hard implies uncaring. I wouldn't see that. I wouldn't see that there. But, I mean, you know, she's notorious for giving as good as she gets. I don't know if you remember that retort when she was in the Senate and one of her colleagues across the chamber was shouting out at her, "Sit down, fatty, sit down, fatty." And she finally just stopped what she was saying and said, "Hey, better big in the backside than bulldust for brains." And she's done that throughout her career, and I actually admire that approach.
So what can women learn from the way female politicians have been treated by the system so far?
My final chapter is saying, okay, what are the tips? What do you learn from the mistakes that the women made in the 1990s? And they did make some mistakes, and they also were poorly treated. So what do we make of it? How do we press forward? And I was torn between saying, okay, of course you should say, you know, stuff it, be yourself, wear what you want to wear, say what you want to say, but just break and crash through this rigid kind of bland political system, because people do want difference. But then we know what happens to people who have tried it. So I kind of walked that fine line between saying, okay, don't buy into a personality cult, be careful what you wear, be really strong on your policy, but at the same time, don't give up on being human.
We will have to wait and see how the press and public relates to Julia Gillard, the deputy opposition leader of the ALP. She's one of the more prominent women in politics at the moment, along with Queensland Deputy Premier Anna Bligh. Finally, in 2006 I spoke to Marion Sawyer, Chief Investigator of the Democratic Audit of Australian Democracy at the Australian National University. I asked her what the audit revealed about the pre-selection of women candidates in Australia.
Disappointingly, Australia has slipped backwards at the federal level in terms of the representation of women in the National Parliament. We've just slid to the 29th place on the Interparliamentary Union's league table of national parliaments on the representation of women. And basically how this has come about is that the Liberal Party has been pre-selecting fewer women at each federal election since 96, and something very similar seems to have been going on at the state level as well. As we can see, for example, in Victoria, where women make up about 38% of the Parliamentary Labor Party, but only 14% of the Parliamentary Liberal Party. So as a proportion of the Parliamentary Labor Party, women are three times more present than they are in the Parliamentary Liberal Party. So that's the reason why Australia's slipping back at the national level, is because there the Liberal Party is in government and they're not putting enough women into Parliament.
So it is the ALP's quotas that have greatly increased the proportion of women in the Australian Parliament, although this is despite the Liberal Party's distaste for such quotas. And with the federal election looming later this year, who knows if there will be a new era of women politicians. But there's still a long way to go to equal representation. Let's hope it's earlier than Janet Powell's prediction of the year 2300. That's all from me, Sarah Lestrange. You've been listening to a special series, On the Record, 20 Years of Women's Radio, which follows key feminist issues from the Women on the Line radio archives. Many thanks go to the Victorian Women's Trust for funding this historic project. And thanks also to all the contributors to Women on the Line on both sides of the microphone in the last 20 years. You're the ones who have made this project possible. The theme music for this series is Chop In by Minimum Chip.
ECR's turn 40, and from Monday 10th of October right through to Saturday 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.